Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Senator Joseph McCarthy first seized headlines in 1950 when he falsely claimed to have the names of more than 200 communists within the U.S. State Department. At the time, Americans thought the newly elected President Dwight David Eisenhower would stand up to the Wisconsin legislator. Why didn't Ike put up a fight? It's a question history buffs have wrestled with over the decades. Historian David Nichols argues that he did put up a fight. He documented the president's behind-the-scenes takedown in his new book entitled Ike and McCarthy, Dwight Eisenhower's Secret Campaign Against Joseph McCarthy. David Nichols joins us by phone from Kansas. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm honored to be with you, Ann.
The book is as much about Dwight Eisenhower is anything, not a really well-known president, except that he was, you know, a general and, you know, he was militarily, you know, well thought of. But other than that, not very well known by most Americans.
Well, I think that's true, even for the Republican Party these days. And he's one of the historic figures in the Republican Party. But historians have been catching up with Ike for decades. My profession kind of ignored him, partly because of some political bias. East Coast liberal Democrats didn't quite forgive him for defeating Adlai Stevenson for winning the presidency, but also because his presidential library is clear out in Abilene, Kansas, which is a very small town in a rural area that that scholars don't always want to go to such places.
He was popular, though. He was well liked. No one disliked him.
No, he had a 58% approval rating in the Gallup poll when he left office. So he was very popular. But the story that has not been told until now is how he really took on Joe McCarthy. But you know, the key to it is to understand people were confused because Ike was very secretive about this. He refused to even use McCarthy's name in public. He not only refused to take him on, he would not use his name. I couldn't find a single instance where he ever did use McCarthy's name in a public statement.
And that was absolutely on purpose and part of his larger strategy.
Yeah, well, he thought that it would give McCarthy greater prestige if the president took him on, and he thought Harry Truman had made a mistake in doing that, because McCarthy's popularity only increased during the Truman years. And Ike also thought it would bug him, and he also thought that if he took him on directly, it would make him the president issue, not Joe McCarthy, and let him off the hook.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the dynamics between then-President Dwight Eisenhower in the first couple years of his presidency and Senator Joe McCarthy, the namesake of McCarthyism, making outrageous allegations with very little evidence to back them up, and how Eisenhower managed to bring down Joe McCarthy behind the scenes. Didn't get a lot of credit for it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Joe McCarthy, when by the time Eisenhower took office, where was he in his trajectory of fame?
Well, he had, as you noted, made his reputation first in 1950 with those charges about communists in the State Department, which you correctly said he did not have those names. Mm-hmm. And so he got a new platform when I got elected president, because the Republicans won a one-vote majority in the United States Senate. And as a result, McCarthy was appointed chair of the Government Operations Committee, and more important, its investigative subcommittee, a permanent investigative subcommittee, which he then used for the next 2 years to chase all kinds of people he accused of being communist. He held one senator hearings. He accused people of guilt by association. He had hearing after hearing after hearing using this committee, and that in effect gave him a new platform for going after things. But he also gave Eisenhower some fits. I don't know how much you want to talk about that.
Sure.
But he held up some of Eisenhower's appointments. Senators, you know, can put a hold on appointments.
Yeah,
so
we've noticed. Yes.
So General Beadle Smith, who had been Ike's chief of staff, in Europe during the war, Ike nominated him to be Deputy Secretary of State. And McCarthy put a hold on that. This is one of Ike's closest buddies and allies. And he fiercely opposed Eisenhower's nomination of Charles Bohlen to be ambassador to the Soviet Union in the wake of the death of Joseph Stalin, the Soviet Union's dictator. And Eisenhower won that one by a vote of 74 to 13, ultimately, but it was tough. It was fierce. But once again, Eisenhower never took on McCarthy in public. He would say to the news people in his press conference, he would say he speaks in principles, not personalities. And he just would not do it. And he had all kinds of friends, including his brother Milton, who urged him to tear McCarthy apart with a big speech. And he told Milton he was not going to get in the gutter with that guy.
How much did the idea or the issue of them coming from the same party, Republicans, enter into the dynamic of all of that? I mean, he'd be trashing, sure, this demagogue, but also a member of his own party.
Well, that's exactly right. That's the dilemma he had, because arguably McCarthy was the most prestigious senator, perhaps the most prestigious politician in the country, with the exception of Eisenhower, who was in kind of a unique situation. So he was on top of the political world in 1953. And by January 1954, he had a Gallup poll rating of 50% positive, 29% negative. He was, as Eisenhower wrote in his memoirs, riding high.
You know, people talk about Donald Trump making stuff up, which he does, and nobody really knows where it comes from. There's very little evidence to back it up. His supporters are nonplussed by this. They don't care. What was the mood of the country that Joseph McCarthy could, you know, reach that kind of acclaim, even though he was making stuff up?
Well, Richard Hofstadter, a great historian, wrote that we have a paranoid style in American politics, and that paranoia bubbles up about once every generation. That once every generation, the American people just get scared, and they were scared about communist infiltration in the 50s, scared about terrorism now, and when you have that kind of fear rampant, then demagogues can use it. They can make up things, and people get worried. You know, we hear about fake news these days. Well, Joe McCarthy was a master of 50s version of fake news. So he'd make announcements of all kinds that had no substance, whatever. But he became prestigious enough that nobody really challenged him, and people in his own party didn't challenge him. And, you know, you have to remember, Eisenhower had this one-vote majority in the United States Senate. And McCarthy had 8 to 12 senators who would go with him on any issue. So how in the world could he get any legislation through if he took on Joe McCarthy?
The story of McCarthy and Eisenhower has been a popular subject among historians. But the conventional wisdom was that Eisenhower didn't do much to fight McCarthy. What were some of the things you learned that were not part of the conventional wisdom?
Well, we have to go into what was a deceptive plan. Let me say one thing about that, Ann, before we get into that, is that we tend to measure presidents by whether they use the bully pulpit or not. And we do to this day. And with all our news media, you know, our news media, and bless them, I love them, thrive on quotations from the president. And Donald Trump has really worked that with his tweets. And so the bully pulpit is, but Eisenhower was a man of action, not a man of words. And furthermore, there's serious presidential scholarship that says presidents do very important things that aren't talked about. And, you know, we love Abraham Lincoln's speeches, but the reason that Lincoln is famous and that we pay attention to his speeches is because he won that war. You know, he did, including some clandestine operations. And so presidents do that. So let me say that. So then the background of what happened is Eisenhower, let me say, did not purposely take on Joe McCarthy in 1953, his first year in office, because he had plenty to pray over. The Korean War was still going on. He managed to end it in July. But the country was still recovering from the anxieties of the Great Depression and World War II, and this Cold War with the Soviet Union made people fearful, and that fear was the lifeblood of McCarthyism. And McCarthy exploited it to the hilt. And so, but during 1953, Eisenhower was not going to take him on. And McCarthy did other things to bug him. He made an illegal agreement with Greek shippers not to send goods to communist China, and eventually was forced to back down on that. He held hearings on communist infiltration of the Voice of America, which was America's propaganda operation in Europe. And he so frightened librarians in the overseas libraries operated by the Voice of America that they started taking books by controversial authors off the shelves. And the Eisenhower administration then got accused of burning books. And that really upset Eisenhower, who was on record saying he hated censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he went to Dartmouth College in June of 1953. He did what now is a fairly famous speech saying to the graduates, don't join the book burners.
Which, again, without ever mentioning Joe McCarthy.
Absolutely, without mentioning his name. So he would go after McCarthy's principles and McCarthy's tactics, but never mention his name.
You know, Eisenhower is an interesting guy. I mean, he comes out of this war. He was also the one that warned about the military-industrial complex. He was a moderate Republican, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, indeed. Although moderation with him, you know, he was a balanced budget hawk.
Yeah.
He believed in balancing budgets.
Well, that was a classical Republican stand, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But on the other hand, he didn't mind having high taxes to pay to keep the budget balanced.
Right.
He didn't go after it. They had up to 90% tax rates on the wealthy in that period, and he didn't go after that. He did spend money. I mean, the interstate highway system is one of the great public works projects of all human history,
mm-hmm.
and that was Ike's baby. You know, and he thought that the government should invest financially in education and in technology, research and development, and in the safety net. He actually enhanced some of the Roosevelt Social Security benefits with proposals in 1954. Having said that, he was a middle-of-the-road guy. He was not a radical person, and I think to call him a moderate would still be appropriate. It's just interesting to me that the Republican Party doesn't cherish him quite that way. It's hard to know what to do with Ike. He's a very complicated guy.
Mm-hmm. Very disciplined. We're going to talk about some of that discipline coming up. We're talking about the efforts by President Eisenhower to take down Joseph McCarthy, the famous demagogue. My guest is David Nichols. He's a historian and an author. His new book is entitled Ike and McCarthy, Dwight Eisenhower's Secret Campaign Against Joseph McCarthy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike
for president.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That's a ditty from the 1952 presidential campaign of Dwight David Eisenhower, who, of course, went on to win the election. Early in his presidency, Eisenhower led a nation twisted in fear of communism, a fear fueled in part by Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, who claimed that communist spies held high positions in the federal government. Rather than denounce him by name, Eisenhower crafted a behind-the-scenes campaign to bring down McCarthy. Historian David Nichols has chronicled this episode in his new book entitled Ike and McCarthy, Dwight Eisenhower's Secret Campaign Against Joseph McCarthy. He joins us by phone from Kansas. If you have a question or comment for David Nichols, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Back in the 50s, let's talk a little bit more about what it meant to be accused of being a communist in the 50s. The House Un-American Activities Committee had been in full swing by this time, right?
Yes, indeed. Indeed, before Eisenhower came to office, House Un-American Activities Committee particularly went after actors and writers and the blacklist.
Hollywood, yeah.
Yes. McCarthy focused more on communists in government, although he did go after some other people like that. But, I think we can say two things. One is that fear of communism and being accused of a communist could tar you. The other thing that we need to say about that, because I put you off at this point of getting it to how Eisenhower went after McCarthy, mm-hmm. but we might want to get that to mm-hmm. that now, is that it was a terribly homophobic period. Just the rumor that someone was gay, not the fact, could cost them their job or cost them an opportunity at a job. And that was true in both parties. It's hard for modern people to get inside how homophobic it really was. But the big story, I can summarize it in one long sentence, is that in January of 1954, starting 54, the Eisenhower team decided to wrap a gay lover scandal around the neck of a prestigious United States senator in the president's own party in a congressional election year. And that's about as tough as it gets in Washington, D.C.
back then. But there was something to what they hung it on. I mean, that had to do with Roy Cohn, right?
That's correct. Roy Cohn and his boyfriend, G. David Shine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Cohn was McCarthy's chief counsel for his investigative subcommittee. He hired him when he was only 25 years old, a legal prodigy.
Mm-hmm.
And Cohn talked McCarthy into adding G. David Shine to his committee as an unpaid consultant. And,
Shine came from a wealthy New York family. He was independent.
That's right. Yeah, particularly a hotel family.
Right.
Very, very wealthy. He had a limousine he drove all the time, drove him and Cohn around. And but the problem began to arise was in July of 1953, David Shine got his draft notice from the Army. And as a result, Roy Cohn frantically sought in every quarter, including at the White House, to try to get Shine a special commission that would let him stay with the McCarthy Committee and, more important to him, to stay with him. And he harassed the Army continually about this and really was put on enormous pressure. And, Shine didn't go to training until late in the year. But after that, Cohn harassed them for time off, for nights and weekends, to do what he euphemistically called committee business at a nearby hotel. And there's that continual harassment and problem. And so in January...
And all of this was on record. I mean, they kept track of every time he called,
oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah, it's all documented.
Right.
And I need to say to you, Ann, I'm not a journalist. I'm not a pundit. If there's something isn't in a document really provable, mm-hmm. I don't use it.
Yeah.
The documents are there, and we can talk about that later, why they're there. Part of them are there because Eisenhower ordered Fred Seaton, who later became Secretary of the Interior and Assistant Secretary of Defense, to gather up thousands of McCarthy documents. And I'll come back to that in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But January 1954 is the turning point. And on January 21st, 1954, Eisenhower's key advisors meet in the Attorney General's office. Ike knew about this meeting and was briefed about it afterwards. And at that meeting, the Army Counsel John G. Adams informed them in detail about all the pressures that Cohn had brought to bear to get special privileges for G. David Shine. Now, McCarthy was involved in those pressures, but he was kind of in and out of it. Cohn was the consistent one about it.
And was McCarthy aware of what he was doing? I mean, did he know about Shine and Cohn?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and one of the unanswered questions I was never able to answer altogether is why McCarthy didn't fire Cohn.
Yeah.
When he became such a problem, and he did not. And I asked a journalist, a Newsweek journalist who's since passed on, about that. And he said, well, we believe that Joe himself was gay.
And although he did get married during this period, yeah.
They wouldn't let us write about it. I'm not sure that's true because some other reputable authors have questioned the rumors about Joe himself. I don't think there's any question about Roy Cohn. He died of AIDS in 1986, although he never came out of the closet.
He didn't. I didn't know that.
Yeah, but anyway, in January 21st of 1954, the administration got all the details on this, and they decided to use this scandal to go after Joe McCarthy. And John G. Adams, the Army Counsel, sent him a stack of documents. They sent him back to the Pentagon and told Fred Seaton. Fred Seaton was a Kansan, close to Eisenhower. They told him to edit that into a publishable document, which they did a couple of months later. It's a long story. It's a great whodunit, man, because they didn't release this right away. It needed to be done right with the right timing, and Dwight Eisenhower is a master of timing. And a master of deception. We've got to remember that this is the general who fooled the entire German general staff about when and where the biggest military armada in human history would land in Europe. And deception was in his bones. And this was a very deceptive operation. But there were things that happened. Well, I'm babbling on.
No, that's okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the effort by Dwight Eisenhower as president to bring down Joe McCarthy, the senator who was bound and determined to catch every communist, even if they weren't a communist, in the federal government. My guest is David Nichols. He's an historian and author of Ike and McCarthy, Dwight Eisenhower's Secret Campaign Against Joseph McCarthy. No, I mean, there is so much. There's so many details going on, but I don't think you can talk too much about how Dwight Eisenhower brought his military timing and patience to this. A lot, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of people very close to him couldn't believe that he wouldn't just start lashing out at McCarthy right away.
No, he just he's on record saying, and this is a quote, that the president can't afford to name names.
Right, and that he's not alone in that. There's other presidents that have been like that before. It drove McCarthy nuts. I mean, right off the bat, during even when he was running for president, he didn't even want to be seen with him.
Oh, that's right. No, there's. The whole prologue of the book deals with his meeting with McCarthy in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's not one of Ike's best times.
Yeah.
He was naive as a politician, and McCarthy had attacked his mentor, the great George Marshall, and in effect accused him of treason. And so Ike had planned to stick a rhetorical thumb in McCarthy's eye. This was on October 3rd, 1952, during the campaign. And he was going to give a speech that night, and he put 74 words of praise into his speech, praise for Marshall. And but that the Wisconsin politicians surrounded Eisenhower on the train and pressured him and said, look, we're liable to lose Wisconsin's electoral votes if you go ahead with this. And they pressured him, so he finally said, fine, take it out. But unfortunately, the New York Times had already picked up a hint that those words were
which had been leaked to them. Yeah.
Yeah, had been leaked to them and by one of Eisenhower's people. And then Joe McCarthy came out and claimed that he had talked Eisenhower into taking it out, which was not true. It took a while. Ike relived that one down. He was angry about it. But once again, did not spout off in public. His discipline about that is extraordinary. But you know, in January of 54, the turning point came. And Eisenhower, in effect, decided to declare political war on McCarthy. It got exacerbated when McCarthy grilled General Ralph Zwicker, who had been at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. Ralph Zwicker. One of the heroes of the war in Europe, one of Ike's most treasured generals who had been commanded by Eisenhower, and McCarthy grilled him and pushed him because Zwicker had under his command a dentist named Irving Perez. This is Joe McCarthy. He would never pick on the big people. He'd pick on people down
right.
in the ranks.
Yes.
Yeah. And so Irving Perez had refused to say if he'd ever been a communist when he was sworn into duty. He just invoked his constitutional protections. And McCarthy, of course, labeled him a communist. And so he's grilling Ralph Zwicker about this. And then the climax of this long hearing, where McCarthy just skewers Zwicker, he finally says that Zwicker, quote, is not fit to wear the uniform of the United States Army. That incensed Eisenhower, and it pushed him. Within a month, they would be going to be released this report on the privileges sought for G. David Shine by Roy Cohn and McCarthy. But the Ralph Zwicker thing helped push it along, although they weren't quite ready to release it yet. I had some friends who wanted him to release it then, and say he had this fine sense of timing when to do it. And they did it on March 11th, 1954. And 2 days before that, Senator Ralph Landers, Republican senator from Vermont, attacked McCarthy on the floor of the Senate, viciously attacked him. Unusual for a Republican senator to attack another senator.
Right.
And then that night, quoting Flanders, Edward R. Murrow did his famous See It Now broadcast against McCarthy.
Yeah, let's hear a bit from that. This is broadcast journalist Edward R. Murrow. He's been credited with McCarthy's takedown. Here's a clip from that CBS program, See It Now, broadcast in 1954.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
Oh, thank you, Anne, for having that.
Sure.
That wonderful broadcast.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary. And what needed, Murrow was not working hand in glove with the White House.
You know, right.
He would not have. But it was widely advertised that this broadcast was going to come about.
Okay.
And so the White House people realized that with the Flanders attack, and I think there's reason to believe that they did recruit Flanders, because Flanders had lunch the week before with Sherman Adams, Ike's chief of staff, who was a very good friend of his,
mm-hmm.
and they had been neighboring governors, but they also knew the Murrow broadcast was coming, and so 2 days later they released this report, but I love the Murrow broadcast. We shall not walk in fear one of another. It's words for the ages.
It is words for the ages, but it was given a lot of credit for taking down McCarthy when it wasn't. That wasn't the case.
Well, it was a factor.
It was a factor, it was out there. Yeah, it was the first time anybody really got out there.
But the Eisenhower forces exploited it.
Yeah,
as the ideal time to release this report, and so 2 days later they release it, and they release it to senators. They release it to the papers, and it causes a firestorm of controversy. Such controversy that eventually the McCarthy committee plans hearings, and they are televised hearings. The Democrats on the committee saw to that, be televised hearings. And the acting chair for the hearings, Karl Rove of South Dakota, thought it would maybe last a week to 10 days. Those hearings lasted 2 months, from April 22nd to June 17th, for two solid months. And you got to remember, there were only three major television networks in those days. And so people watched this hour after hour, and the American public did, watched summaries in the evening, and television was a new phenomenon. People were fascinated by their new black and white sets, and it had an enormous impact, and particularly on Joe McCarthy. McCarthy was an alcoholic, no question. Never could get going without a major belt of whiskey in the morning and throughout the day, and that showed on television. He did not come off well on television. So this enormously popular man, you know, he was prestigious. By the time the hearings ended in June 1954, he was upside down in the polls. His political prestige had already been largely destroyed.
How long before he went down after that?
Well, he really was destroyed then. You're probably referring to he was formally censured.
Right.
By the United States Senate by 67-22 vote on December 2nd, 1954.
And what does that mean to be formally censured?
Well, that's a great question on your part, not easy to answer, because eventually it took all the meat out of the resolution. It ended up being a resolution. It would bore your audience to death if I went through what they originally had in it. They had the attack on General Zwicker being unfit as part of it, and they eventually knocked that out. It's the way Senate does things. You know, they get compromises.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ends up being really accusing him of offending the dignity of the United States Senate. And they used the word condemned him, not censure. They condemned him. But by that time, that really is the skeleton at the feast. He was already destroyed. If they hadn't had the censure vote, I'm personally convinced he was done for anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But the hearings is what did it. In the hearings, I would repeat, were stirred up by this report on the privileges sought for G. David Shine. That's what triggered it. That's what the Eisenhower administration used, and used very skillfully. And they did things like, they got Joe Welch, who the attorney, who is kind of famous now for having said to Joe McCarthy, "Sir, have you no sense of decency?"
Mm-hmm.
Joe Welch was recruited by the White House. Now, you have to remember, this was all ostensibly done by the Army.
Right.
But the White House, Eisenhower didn't admit what he did in his memoirs, even. Done by the Army, but in fact, Joe Welch was recruited by Governor Thomas Dewey of New York. Now, why in the world would the governor of New York recruit an attorney for the United States Army?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dwight Eisenhower was really a Dewey Republican, and Dewey would have never done that without Eisenhower's either request or okay. I don't have a document that proves that, but I'm absolutely convinced of it. And so Welch turned out to be a brilliant choice. He was shrewd. He was tough. And as Roy Cohn said in his memoir about McCarthy, that Welch had, quote, an unerring instinct for the jugular. And he did. He was tough. But there were also other things in the hearings. Five times that I can document, the Republicans tried to end the hearings because they were knew they were doing damage not only to McCarthy, but the Republican Party, because
right.
They had an election coming in November. And five times, Eisenhower, behind the scenes, vetoed ending them. He'd worked through the Secretary of the Army. And you know, people would go to the White House and talk to him about it, and he'd say, "Oh, my goodness, isn't it awful? When are those hearings going to end?" But behind the scenes,
right.
Eisenhower did not want them to end. And his Attorney General's memoir makes it clear that they decided early on the hearings were doing such damage to McCarthy, they wanted them to go forward, and they did. And in the final plea, what the account is that the final plea came from Joe McCarthy himself, taken by Army Secretary Robert Stevens to Eisenhower, saying, "Let's end these hearings for the good of the country." And the account says, Ike slapped his desk and said, "No, we've got the bastard right where we want him." And Eisenhower, you know, is a tough, ruthless guy. And this grandfatherly act he did in public, so many journalists just thought this man would rather play golf than be president. And frankly, I don't understand his secrecy at times. I think he overdoes it. But he was a shrewd cat.
We're talking about Dwight Eisenhower as president and his secret campaign against Joseph McCarthy. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. One of Dwight Eisenhower's presidential hangnails involved Senator Joseph McCarthy, a fellow Republican from Wisconsin. In the 1950s, McCarthy threw the nation's political elite into turmoil with reckless and unsubstantiated charges that communist spies were working inside the federal government. His rhetoric and actions eventually became known as McCarthyism. So we're talking about how President Eisenhower engineered the downfall of McCarthy. Still with us is historian and author David Nichols. His new book is entitled Ike and McCarthy, Dwight Eisenhower's Secret Campaign Against Joseph McCarthy. You mentioned a little bit earlier, David Nichols, the penchant that Joe McCarthy had for nailing the little guy. One of the saddest episodes of that I read in your book was when he targeted a civilian clerical employee in the Army. A woman, an African-American woman who lost her job over this. A lot of the appeasement in that regard came from the secretary of the defense secretary, Stevens, right?
The secretary of the Army.
Secretary of the Army, yeah.
Yeah, and Doris Walters Powell, you're talking about.
Right.
Was one of the first people he had in the hearing. This was his first hearing on communists in the Army on August 31st, 1953. And I might mention that I'm now convinced that when he started those hearings, this is starting hearings in communists in the Army with a five-star Army general in the White House.
Right.
Small wonder that Eisenhower believed that McCarthy wanted to run for president.
Right.
He's on record. He said he's got the bug to run for president, and he'll never get to do it if I can do anything about it. But he started, and he went after Doris Walters Powell, who was this low-level clerk who was on maternity leave.
Right.
And she eventually lost her job, by the way, due to McCarthy's harassment. And so he would go after these lower-level people, but he could get headlines out of it, and that's what he did. But those hearings went on and on and on for a long time, and eventually ended up, as I said, with Ralph Zwicker being accused of being unfit to wear the uniform in the United States Army. But Robert Stevens was naive in dealing with McCarthy. Stevens kept thinking he could be friendly with him and get along with him, and Stevens just wasn't equipped to deal with this extraordinary senator. One thing we ought to say about Joe McCarthy, he had talents. He had a wonderfully public relations talent. That some people have compared to Donald Trump.
Right.
He really had a flair for getting headlines, for getting attention. And also, in fairness to him, we have to say there were indeed spies in the United States government in those days. That's been well documented.
It was the Cold War.
It was indeed. And mm-hmm. We had spies in the Soviet Union. Excuse me. But there's no evidence that Joe McCarthy ever caught one.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there was a real thing there. You mentioned, I mean, he's often compared to, well, lots of op-eds have been published comparing Joseph McCarthy to President Donald Trump. You mentioned that one talent. Do you see any other similarities?
Well, there is a link.
Yes, Roy Cohn.
Roy Cohn, was a very young man when he went to work for McCarthy. And when McCarthy was disgraced in 1954, Cohn returned to New York and resumed his law practice and became known as one of the most ruthless attorneys in the city. And in 1973, he advised Joe McCarthy and his father, because they were being sued for housing discrimination by the federal government.
Right.
And Cohn's advice to them was, tell them to go to hell and take them to court. And so after that, Cohn became Trump's advisor, mentor, as well as attorney for 13 years. And there's reason. No, this is not part of my book, and it's not something I'm expert on, I must say to you.
But it's well known.
Yeah, it is, and there's no question about it. There's been some good writing on it, and many of the techniques that McCarthy that Trump uses with the public is not unlike McCarthy in many respects. You know, you tell a big lie and stick to it. You exploit people's fears. You give them scapegoats. You know, above all, get headlines in one way or another, and you never apologize, never apologize, and you know. But there is one big difference between Joe McCarthy and Donald Trump is that Joe McCarthy never became president,
even though he wanted to, or is believed
yeah.
to have been wanted to. James from Erie County, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hi there. I've heard a story, it's anecdotal, but I believe it, from a reliable source that Ike used to keep a special handkerchief in the Oval Office in the drawer of his desk. And when he became angry, he would fold it, and then he would tear it to pieces. And this was his way of venting. And he was a very self-controlled person. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, I have, and I can't document that being factual. But I can confirm with you that Ike had a voracious temper. people, Ike said it went off like a rocket, and you just once he got angry, you just didn't want to be around him for a while. He really and quite profane. You know, this is the guy who starts his inaugural address with a prayer, and has a prayer in his farewell address, and starts every cabinet meeting with prayer, but in between. His language is richly the language of an old soldier, and when he was angry, he'd do it, and then the temper tantrum would pass, and he'd be very cold and calculating. But he never did it in public, never in public. However angry he was, he had this kind of strange self control. Frankly, I don't understand Eisenhower altogether. He's an extraordinarily complicated man. So I can't refute your story. It sounds like him.
James, thanks a lot for that call. Dale in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Yeah, this might be an unusual question for a historian, but he probably has some insight. What does he think the effect that Roy Cohn had, because he was Trump's lawyer back in the day,
right?
On how Donald Trump lives, breathes, and acts today.
Hmm. Yeah, we were just talking about that a little bit. It's kind of hard to tell, but go ahead, David Nichols.
Well, as I say, some of the techniques are remarkably similar, that you attack your critics. Cohn taught him that, you know, attack them fiercely. And never apologize for anything you say. Don't hesitate to, if you tell a lie, tell a big one, stick to it. Never back off from it. Whatever people are scared about is something you can make your reputation with. And so I think there's remarkable similarity. How much of that owns influence and how much of it was it's like McCarthy and Cohn. McCarthy had this inclination to do that before he got associated with Cohn.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing it for 3 years, in fact, before he got associated with Cohn.
Right.
So this is birds of a feather stuff a little bit. Yeah, these people fit together, and for reasons that are not just one influencing the other.
Dale, thanks a lot for that call. Wow, I mean it's kind of hard. I wanted you to talk a little bit about before we wrap it up, just about the whole McCarthyism thing. I mean it's a you know a common term now. Everybody knows what it means, kind of. That's quite something to have your name stick like that to a behavior.
Yes, and everybody uses the term. Even Donald Trump used it a while back to describe the Obama administration. So the term gets used without knowing what the substance is in many cases. But you know, we need to say that there was more to McCarthyism than McCarthy. That you mentioned early in our conversation about the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Right.
That was in operation and doing lots of things before McCarthy even became prominent, or certainly before Eisenhower became president. And much of the Red Scare kind of stuff went on after McCarthy. We got to remember that McCarthy was ill. He was a raving alcoholic. And after the censure, when he'd stand up to speak on the Senate floor, his colleagues would leave. They wouldn't sit with him in the dining room. He became a pariah.
Yeah.
And became ill. And John G. Adams, the Army Counsel, visited him in 1955 and found him having lost 40 pounds. He set out and poured 6 ounces of gin, but he couldn't he couldn't get it in his mouth without it dribbling. He just looked awful, and Adams left the house that day, looking back at the man in the door, calling him the cadaverous image of McCarthyism, getting ready to die. And Joe McCarthy did die in 1957 at the age of 48, really quite young.
Yeah.
But the McCarthyism, the Red Scare that we're talking about, went on after his death to some extent, and certainly mm-hmm. preceded him.
Right, right. It was a whole era that sort of summed up in his name, because he's the one. Even the House Un-American Activities Committee, you know, I've read a lot of the transcripts from that in the past, and no one really stands out in that the way he did in the Senate.
Well, Joe was a true talent in mm-hmm. public relations. I mean, he really carved out a niche for himself.
And the idea that he wanted to be president goes to the point that he picked on the Army, of course, with Eisenhower being, you know, former, you know, general. I mean, obviously known for his experiences in the Army during World War II and so forth in the Korean War. If the next president had been somebody, an admiral from the Navy, it's likely that McCarthy would have just gone after the Navy instead, right? I mean,
that's a reasonable surmise,
yeah.
Certainly. You know, one thing we need to say about that, though, Eisenhower was vulnerable in that he had had very cozy relationships with the Soviet Union during the war.
Right.
And after the war, and with communists, as he was supervising Germany in the wake of the end of the war.
And he knew that.
And McCarthy, we know McCarthy had a file on all that.
Yeah.
And Ike's friends in particular were just certain McCarthy was going to pull all that out. As it turns out, he never got the chance to.
Right, right. Well, David Nichols, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, it is an honor to be with you, and thank you.
David Nichols, historian and author of Ike and McCarthy, Dwight Eisenhower's Secret Campaign Against Joseph McCarthy. We'll have a link to more about the book on our website at WOSU.org. Want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Linnett, All Sides interns Sarah Stacey and Kyle McKinnon, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.